This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Overprotecting our kids. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Parents and towns are trying to find ways to give today's children more independence, which could decrease their high levels of anxiety.
Latest housing trend, modern designs in homes made of shipping containers.
The growing percentage of former major leaguers who have sons now playing pro baseball.
And looking at the point in time when smart cars and smart cities start talking with each other.
Now, the goal for this isn't so cars can get chatty and suddenly they're telling stories about their drivers, so that would be a lot of fun. It's so that if one car sees a problem, it can notify another car so the other car can avoid it.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle on enhancing autonomous driving. He's here later in the hour. Investigators probing two deadly crashes of Boeing 737 MAX airliners are dealing with a hybrid of old and new technology, where a complex piece of software controls hydraulic pumps and motors similar to those used when Lyndon Johnson was president. Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Michaels says the plane, first designed in the 1960s and modernized three times, is caked with successive generations of technology superimposed on each other. He's with us from his post in Brussels. Dan, explain.
So one of the issues that investigators are focused on with the MAX crashes is this, a system that stops the plane from stalling accidentally. And it was introduced in the most recent version of the plane that was developed 4 or 5 years ago. The plane itself was first developed in the 1960s. It's been modernized three times. Each time, a new layer of more advanced technology was introduced. And one thing that these crashes appear to show, it's not conclusive, is that you can get some unexpected consequences when you introduce digital control, software, automation to a piece of equipment that previously was mechanical or much simpler, especially if the operators, in this case pilots, are unaware of the system or aren't clear how the system works, or there's some unexpected interaction between the new software and the older physical equipment.
You said, too, even before the Internet of Things becomes a pervasive reality, tech experts and public safety pros are fretting over the intersection of virtual and real in what they call cyber-physical security. So that takes on a more broad meaning here, obviously.
Exactly. I mean, we're all familiar with cybercrime, hacking, malware, but so far, most of it has focused on the virtual world of the Internet. We have our bank accounts on the Internet, and our money is dematerialized. If it gets stolen, it's stolen. But it's in this virtual world. The Internet and most of the connected world so far hasn't been physical. It's been virtual, but it's starting to get physical because digital technology is allowing sensors on all sorts of things, and the ability to transmit data is growing exponentially. People talk about the Internet of Things, where your refrigerator, and even smart home devices are a step towards that. Everything is getting connected to the Internet, and 5G technology is going to push that. And so all these problems that have existed in the virtual world of the Internet will already do, or starting to, and will very much more, pose a threat to the physical world that we live in.
Wow. All right. So in what realm are hackers, for example, rubbing their hands together in excitement?
It really runs the gamut from kind of malicious activity just to mess with things. But what really scares people is the physical equivalent of the malware attacks. So like a ransom, taking a facility hostage and saying, if you want your factory back, you have to pay us. Or even beyond that, taking control of some kind of facility to cause actual physical damage. Most of the damage that's been caused by hackers and malware so far has been either financial or emotional or reputational, but very little of it has been actual direct physical harm. But now, it is increasingly possible. I mean, there have been attacks so far. In fact, Ukraine has been a testing ground for Russian attacks on things like the power grid. But we had an article recently in the Wall Street Journal about how Russian hackers got into the U.S. power grid. Didn't do harm, but had the potential to.
So retrofitting then, kind of circling back to the 737 MAX, is retrofitting the most dangerous of all?
It's more dangerous in many ways. If you're going to develop new technology that's digitally controlled, like an electric car or a drone or an advanced medical device, it's a physical piece of equipment with software and computer controls. And the software is developed at the same time as the hardware. The two are integrated from the outset, and it may not be done well, but chances are there is a thought paid to security, safety, and what happens if this thing gets hacked. But if you've got something like a petrochemical plant that has existed for decades, and maybe even had computer controls, but those computer controls were never networked to anything, and you start adding internet connections, remote connections, maybe, you open this facility to the potential for just innocent software bugs, just bad software, or malware, hacking, completely unforeseen interactions.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Michaels, Wall Street Journal reporter in Brussels. It's 13 minutes now after the hour. Final weekend in March. Glad you could spend part of it with us. Amazon and China, two forces that are often blamed for killing American employment in retail and manufacturing, is helping a rebound in American paper mills. The reason for the revival has to do with the millions of packages that Amazon and other online retailers ship around the world, specifically the humble cardboard used to construct them. Over the past 5 years, e-commerce has fueled demand for billions more square feet of cardboard. Michael Corkery, reporter at the New York Times, says an industry that has struggled mightily during the digital age has a rare opportunity for growth. He paid a visit to a mill in Combined Locks, Wisconsin. Michael, what'd you find?
You know, you really think of, you know, Amazon and it, as the poster child of a digital company, you know, as a bit of a job destroyer, not a job creator, at least in the U.S. You know, you think of all these stores that have closed because of e-commerce and, the, you know, this sort of death of brick and mortar retailing as a result of the growth of e-commerce. And yet here's an area where e-commerce, though it lives online, still needs this very physical, very old-fashioned thing called paper to make the boxes that the stuff gets delivered in. So it's a bit of a twist on the usual tale.
Wow. We're speaking with Michael Corkery, business reporter at the New York Times. He's written a piece entitled The Great American Cardboard Comeback. So part of this, too, is tied to China basically saying to the U.S., stop sending us your cardboard to be recycled. We're not doing it anymore. You figure it out. And that has helped here as well, to a certain extent.
Yeah. So that's another factor that's come into play. You know, for decades, the U.S., again, when you'd use you get your Amazon box, you'd break it down, you'd put it out to be recycled. A lot of those boxes, a lot of your plastic bottles, a lot of your aluminum cans were being picked up, processed here in the U.S., put on barges and sent over to China, where they were, you know, really being sorted and recycled and turned into new bottles, new boxes, new paper. But in January of 2018, China said, you know what? Most of the stuff we're getting from the U.S. is filled with garbage. I mean, it's contaminated. We're having to bury a lot of it or burn a lot of it. We don't want it anymore. And when they decided that, that really disrupted the sort of market for scrap material. And the prices of all those materials collapsed, and including the price of used cardboard, which, again, has been very difficult for recycling centers. But it's been great for mills, which is many of these brown paper mills that use scrap cardboard to sort of chew it up and make new pulp to create new brown paper. So it's really lowered the costs, which again, for this mill and combined locks, as they were trying to get back on their feet, they had a great, you know, their raw material has never been cheaper.
Is this not the only mill that's benefited?
There's actually a bit of a revival going on around the U.S. Conversions like the one in this Wisconsin mill that had been making white paper that changed over to brown. Interestingly, there's a Chinese company that the biggest brown paper and box maker in Asia, this company called Nine Dragons, that really relied on a lot of the scrap coming out of the U.S. It no longer could get it in China. So what they've done is this Chinese company has come to the U.S. and bought paper mills just in the past year and reopened them in places like Maine, West Virginia, to do the same thing as what this mill was doing in Wisconsin. So again, a twist on the old tale where China is coming here and creating American jobs, not the usual where our American jobs are often shipped over to China, and we lose that employment here in the States.
And given our passion for all things delivered by cardboard boxes these days, it seems like this is a sustainable business model for the foreseeable future.
It is. I mean, the box world, it's not exactly an exciting industry, but this is about as exciting as it's ever been in terms of growth and opportunity. Now, of course, you know, this mill in Wisconsin and the ones I mentioned by of the Chinese company, they're not the only ones that have figured this out. So, you know, a lot of mills are jumping on this opportunity, and so that's going to create some more capacity coming online. So eventually this boom will probably slow, but for now it's really at least for this mill, it's been a really happy revival.
Thanks, Michael. Michael Corkery, reporter at the New York Times. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. In the so-called sharing economy, even when love is no longer mutual, bills for entertainment and communication often are. Streaming music and video services that permit multiple users, plus the proliferation of family cell phone plans in recent years, have created ties that bind long after a breakup or even divorce. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Breaking up is bad enough, but it's even worse if you share passwords. Sarah Krauss of the Wall Street Journal has written about this dilemma when it comes to streaming movie subscriptions, video services, and friends and family cell phone plans, and joins us now. Sarah, what are couples doing about these shared passwords when they break up?
Some couples are just keeping their current arrangements in place. They keep paying their respective bills for shared streaming services and continue sharing their passwords even after they've broken up.
What are some of the reasons that they're keeping it?
Some of it's about convenience. It's time-consuming and in some cases not even possible to export your viewing or your listening preferences to a new account. On cell phone bills, it can be particularly tricky to move on to a new plan and get both people to go to a store or give consent to make changes to an account. And in other cases, it's just a monetary question. It saves both members of the couple money to keep sharing those services.
Is there a big cost advantage to keeping it rather than going to an individual plan?
I mean, there can be if you are sharing the cost between the two of you. You know, for a Spotify, you know, family plan, it's $14.99 a month divided by two. You know, versus, you know, one person paying that, or even splitting a solo plan is about $10 a month. So that's, you know, $5 each versus $10 each. You know, for Netflix, you know, you're talking anywhere from $9 to $13. You know, at the sort of low end of their plan base. So that is a way to save money if you sort of go on it together.
Now, Sarah, I know for your story you talked to a number of couples. Share some of those stories with us about how they approach this.
Yeah, so there's one student that I talked to who is on a Spotify premium plan with several friends and her ex-boyfriend, and she just sends a Venmo charge to each of them bi-monthly and, you know, collects their part of the bill that way. Another couple that I talked to, you know, one member paid for Hulu and the other paid for Netflix and Spotify, so they sort of, you know, divided the cost of those plans between them and either, you know, found a way to split the cost down the middle in terms of the plans they paid for, or, you know, used modern payment apps and tools to just send each other the money that's owed.
We're speaking with Sarah Krause of the Wall Street Journal. I would imagine, too, that this sometimes does not work out if it's not a great breakup.
No, it's not for everyone, and there are privacy concerns to think about as well. You know, do you want somebody, you know, being able to see your viewing habits or your listening habits, or in the case of a cell phone plan, you know, depending on who the primary account holder is, you know, who you're calling or texting. So there are serious privacy concerns to consider in doing this, and this arrangement is definitely not for everyone.
What do companies think about this?
I mean, some of the streaming services have cut down on the number of simultaneous viewers or watchers. So you have seen some changes to plan structures as a result of that, where you have to pay extra if you want simultaneous viewing or listening.
Were you surprised by any of the stories that people told you, or unaware that people were doing this at all?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's sort of a sign of the sharing economy that we all live in. You know, as one person I talked to mentioned, you know, we get into Ubers with strangers, you know, and we don't think that's strange. So, you know, is it really all that weird that someone you've dated shares a, you know, video service together? So it's, you know, it's unlike a car insurance, you know, where it might be tied to a shared address or legal union. I mean, these are arrangements, whether it's Amazon Prime, Netflix, Spotify, or cell phone plans where, you know, you can be just friends on it, or you can be fantasy football league members together on it. There aren't really like boundaries of who can participate on the same plan.
It is this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krause. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Final weekend in March. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, when cars and cities start talking to each other. Also, shipping container homes with modern designs and father-son combos in Major League Baseball. Love that story in about 20 minutes. Why is it that we don't let our kids walk to school alone? Parents and communities are figuring out ways to give their children more independence, and it just may help them to become less anxious and more self-reliant adults. Wall Street Journal contributing writer Andrea Peterson took a deep dive on the subject. Andrea, set this up.
There's been so much kind of hand-wringing from many people about the fact that kids today just don't seem to have as much independence or autonomy as they did a few, you know, a generation or two ago. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, and I remember walking to school by myself, 8 or 9 years old, riding my bike all over town. And those things just are not that typical for today's kids.
And what happened? We start getting spooked by any random crime story that they'd have to throw,
you know,
on cable news,
you know,
to fill 24 hours?
It's hard to know exactly what happened, but there does seem to be sort of this general hysteria that's taken over. I mean, news about, you know, with things with social media, you know, you hear about that kidnapping that happened across the world, you know, or that you wouldn't necessarily have heard of or wouldn't have traveled that quickly. And also just you know, so social media kind of amplifies those horror stories that you know, happen very, very rarely. And also, you know, just the rise of sort of parenting advice books and blogs and things. There just seems to be a lot more just hand-wringing and nervousness around, you know, am I doing this parenting thing right?
Yeah. How do we begin to reverse course, Andrea?
Right. I mean, there is, you know, and actually, you know, going along with that, there's actually even been some very high-profile cases of parents actually being charged with neglect for allowing their kids to walk or play unsupervised. I mean, that's the thing, you know, you're always, you know, you know, there have been instances where, you know, people call the cops or, you know, they shame people on social media if they are perceived to be sort of neglectful. We are sort of seeing kind of a backlash to all that kind of parental oversight. Actually, earlier last year, actually, the state of Utah enacted a new free-range parenting law that redefined neglect to specifically exclude things like letting a child play in a park or walk to a nearby store. But sort of the question that I had, you know, as I was going into this, so, okay, we all can agree that there's been this you know, the pendulum has sort of swung to being incredibly overprotective of our kids. But so if you do want to encourage autonomy in your kids, sort of how do you go about doing it, especially when, you know, your neighbors may not be so, you know, because, you know, there is sort of this societal kind of trend to be more protective. And, you know, that happened to I actually left my daughter, this kind of happened sort of on happenstance. I had to leave my daughter home alone for the first time. She's nine. Because my husband was out of town, she was sick, and I had to go to the drugstore to get her some medicine. And we sort of winged it. I really didn't have a plan, but I, you know, made sure that I quizzed her on my cell phone number, showed her where our landline is that we almost never use. Right. And, you know, I went to the drugstore, got what I needed, came back, and we were both fine. We were a little rattled, but we were fine. But when I told my husband, he was like, you know, why did you do, you know, she could have hit her head or, right. you know, something, you know, things that had actually happened when she's actually been in our presence.
Sure. We're speaking with Andrea Peterson, contributing writer to the Wall Street Journal, also author of a book called On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. And she's got a piece entitled The Overprotected American Child. You said, too, that overzealous parenting can do harm. How so?
That's right. And so there is another, I think, that's kind of fueling this drive for people to give more autonomy to their kids is this growing evidence that being overprotective can actually hurt kids. And, you know, psychologists and educators see that as one factor that's fueling this real rise in the number of kids and young adults being diagnosed with anxiety disorders in particular. That, you know, in a 2017 survey of college students, you know, found that almost 22% said that they had been diagnosed with or treated for anxiety problems during the previous year. And that's up from about 10% in the 2008 survey. So that's a really huge jump. And another study actually showed that the one sort of parenting behavior that really has the strongest impact on whether you're going to develop anxiety or not is this granting autonomy.
Thanks, Andrea. Wall Street Journal contributing writer, Andrea Peterson. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Qualcomm recently announced advancements with its in-car entertainment, which can be summed up as not just vehicle-to-vehicle technology, but vehicle-to-everything technology. This IT will enhance significantly our autonomous driving future and, where applied, will also enhance traditional human-driven cars in a variety of ways, potentially radically changing not only the safety of our ever-smarter cars, but also improving the overall experience. So says Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Rob, how do you see it?
Now, the goal for this isn't so cars can get chatty and suddenly they're telling stories about their drivers, so that would be a lot of fun. It's so that if one car sees a problem, it can notify another car so the other car can avoid it. So say if there's an accident or a pothole or whatever, regardless of whether the car is autonomous or not, even with the driver, if somebody sees the problem, the car upstream also is aware of the problem and so wouldn't run into it. So it's better for traffic control. It's better for accident avoidance. It certainly would save a lot of us having to replace our wheels. But as this advances, people in cars would be able to converse with each other, as well as cars would be able to converse with each other. And, of course, the cities, which are also becoming smart, they could converse with the cars. And on the good side, the hope would be that it would alleviate a lot of the traffic problems. On the bad side, we could have all whole new and creative ways to curse out drivers that were cars and drivers that weren't behaving properly. But I was also thinking we could have an awful lot of fun with this as well. And you could have groups that form dynamically and decide to go grab lunch. Or let's say I was watching a YouTube video a while back where the guy's driving and a meteor's coming down. And of course, everybody around him is wondering what that is. You could open a dynamic conversation and start discussing, okay, what is that thing? Maybe you might want to stop and wait till it hits so you don't get underneath the damn thing. So
So it could really increase the social connectivity between the people in the cars who are increasingly not driving.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. We're talking about smart cars, talking to themselves, and also talking to smart cities. You referenced, too, rerouting certain numbers of cars to specific highways to sort of hyper-manage volume.
That's right, because, you know, the freeways know what the traffic content is, and as they get smarter, and certainly the cities will know where there's congestion, the cars will know where they're going, the cities will then know where the cars are going, and think of, like, traffic control for airplanes, which is done manually now and eventually will be fully automated. That's what would result. Suddenly, you need to go to point B, but you don't necessarily need to go in a straight line, and you would just simply be automatically routed around any traffic or congestion. And because it knows where everybody else is going, it could route you around congestion that hasn't even occurred yet, because it could see a whole bunch of cars are going to hit this particular street or stoplight at the same time. That's not going to work, so it automatically reroutes all the cars so you never see the traffic. This is going to be particularly important when most of us don't have our own cars and are instead using, you know, automated Uber and Lyft automobiles, and we're using them like horizontal elevators. This way, all those horizontal elevators can get where they're going in a minimal amount of time without congestion or problems. And of course, you're now sitting in that horizontal elevator that's that autonomous Uber or Lyft car, and you can, you know, you're watching movies or you're staying along or doing whatever you're doing, and all you know is you're getting there really fast, and the city and the cars are managing the route and the traffic.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Features like a floating staircase, second floor balcony, and floor to ceiling windows can be found in many of the newer higher end homes in suburban Detroit and throughout the country. But the construction might surprise you. They're made of shipping containers. Reporter Christina Hall at the Detroit Free Press has been looking at them. Chris, what have you found?
Well, we had heard about a home that was being built in Ferndale, which is one of the Detroit suburbs. And this home is pretty high-end, obviously. It's on the market for $450,000. And this was interesting because this was apparently another home. We had heard about a home in Royal Oak, which is a neighboring suburb from Ferndale, a shipping container home that was built several years ago that is occupied. And so I started doing a little research, and I found that home, and I saw this one, and then I saw a couple others, and I spoke to the folks, took a tour of the house, wanted to see what it looked like. And when I spoke to one of the folks in Ferndale, he said, yeah, we have a handful of these going up. And then I talked to a builder who said, yeah, we're doing a few here in Ferndale. We're doing some in Royal Oak. We're talking to folks in Hazel Park. And there's been some projects down in Detroit, but this seemed to be one of the first times it was really picking up steam in the Detroit suburbs. And these particular suburbs we were talking about are in Oakland County, which is just, you know, just across from Detroit. And it seemed like most of the development was there, though one of the folks did tell me that there was some interest in developing in northern Macomb County, and that was also a possibility of a shipping container home, which would be probably in a more rural area. Some of the areas around the suburbs here were more in existing neighborhoods.
Wow. So what do supporters say are the benefits of a shipping container home?
Well, some folks had said that these might be more durable because they're made of steel. I know the folks that I spoke with here, the ladies, they were using waterproof steel. So obviously you have some talk of possibly a better quality home in terms of the bones of the house, the structure. One gentleman I spoke to that happened to be in the neighborhood, he said, you know, well, they're rodent proof. And I don't know, I don't have any proof of that, but I guess it's possible. So there was some potential of strength and durability, reusing, being eco-friendly, and being able to use something that, you know, oftentimes people just see sitting somewhere.
So you mentioned this particular home you looked at in Ferndale, $450,000. I think it was 5.5 shipping containers, 1,800 square feet. Where's all the expense coming from?
Well, some of it was a lot of the touches that they wanted to do in the house itself. So some of the features that they were pointing out were a lot of the reclaimed wood for a kitchen island. They also did reclaimed wood in the laundry area. It was like reclaimed wood and then pipe. The steps were, as they said, handmade, but these were, steel and wood. A more custom construction inside the home. There was tile in the kitchen. I believe there was tile in one of the baths, at least. So a lot of the touches, even on some of the drawer pulls in the kitchen.
Thanks, Chris. Christina Hall at the Detroit Free Press. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us, like father, like son, especially in Major League Baseball. If it seems like the kids of former big leaguers are taking over the sport this spring, it's because they kind of are. 538.com says they're making the majors at rates far greater than the general population. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Kavan Biggio, and Bo Bichette are on the cusps of the majors. Prospects invited to the Blue Jays camp in Dunedin, Florida. Their dads were well-known players in the 90s and early 2000s. In that same clubhouse, by the way, before undergoing surgery, was Mark Leiter Jr. Second-generation prospects are not limited to the Toronto system either. ESPN's Keith Law has San Diego's Fernando Tatis Jr., another legacy, as the game's number one prospect, while Pittsburgh's Ke'Bryan Hayes, son of Charlie, is also a top 20 prospect. Others, Adalberto Mondesi, son of Raul, is expected to be in the Royals starting lineup. Lance McCullers Jr. is a fixture in the Astros rotation when healthy. And slugger Cody Bellinger, son of Clay, has already earned an all-star nod for the Dodgers. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username @GordonDeal. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.